This is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Welcome to the Wandering DMs live stream. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today we're going to be talking about experience in D&D and level differentials.
Sorry, D&D. Everyone.
Where do you start characters, and how much experience do they earn, and what the hell is with 5th edition experience progression, stuff like that.
I think I broke Dan by presenting him weird numbers that he couldn't see the formula in just before we started. Sorry, Dan.
I am very scrambled, but I'm so looking forward to this this mathy oriented interesting discussion.
Awesome, great. So level disparity. Why do we even care? I think that we only care in campaigns where it's long running, and there is a chance for some players to be absent or to die. Or possibly to get level drained. I hear that happened in your campaign recently.
Yep. Yes, very recently. Yeah. I mean, I think that a lot of us, I mean, what is the magical thing that Dungeons and Dragons brought to the table? And I think a lot of people say the persistent, you know, leveling up, gaining experience. That's really the primary reward to your character playing D&D. So experience and when do you level up and what is the differential between different characters is possibly the critical key thing that makes D&D, you know, or, you know, what it is. Mm-hmm. So it seems like a fairly important point about exactly when you give rewards or don't give rewards in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like this may be a bit of a tangent, but certainly I've put a lot of thought too into like what kind of activities give you experience points, because what do I want to motivate my players to do or not motivate them to do?
I totally agree. And I think the theory that you should give experience for what you want to see in your game makes a lot of sense. I personally haven't experimented with a lot of variations, but I totally agree. That is the thing that you ought to be giving experience for what you want to see in the game.
So we've dealt with this in the past because, or specifically level disparity in the past, because we had a campaign where people died, and what do you do when you create a new character? That issue came up. Certainly, this dovetails into a conversation we had 2 weeks ago where we were talking about what do you do when a player's absent? What happens to their character? And I've certainly played with groups that want to make sure that the XP remains the same, other groups that want to say you're not there, you don't get it. Or even then, what is the fiction of where is your character? Are they present? Are they following around mutely? Do they leave? What happens to them?
Yeah, a lot of different ways to approach that. I mean, maybe we should start with just like the, we touched on it last time of like, just where do you start? Like if you just start a completely fresh campaign, no one's done any play, all the players are totally new. Where do you start them? Where do you start them?
I would start at first level.
Yeah.
Zero XP. Yeah. Definitely, that's the way I've always done it. Now, I've had, interestingly, two campaigns start up recently that I am currently running, both in 5th edition. So it's Brave New World for me.
I will be selling you apologies later. What is the traditional Catholic selling, you know, medieval times you'd sell, God, if anybody's watching this, tell me what I'm thinking of.
Jen knows it. What is it, Jen? Indulgences.
Yes, thank you. All right. I will be selling indulgences later for that. But yes, interesting that you're playing 5th edition all of a sudden.
Yeah. Kind of a weird happenstance that I'm doing it in two different places. So one is with a large group at work, and that's perhaps the one that's more making me think about level disparity. The reason for that is we're playing in what's called a West Marches style. Go dig that up on the internet if you've never heard of West Marches. There's a lot of writing on it. But to give you the quick high view, the idea is we have a large group of players, way more than would ever sit at the table at once. I have somewhere between a dozen and 20 players. It's hard for me to count because we're all on a Slack channel chatting about it, and I think some people join that channel just because they were curious to watch what happens and aren't really going to play. But the idea is you have a large sandbox world. All these players have their characters that they made that live in this world. Come up. There's no real. There's no scheduling done by the DM. So we're not at a like regular weekly cadence or anything. What happens is the players in their chat about the world decide, oh, we want to go do this thing. There's this weird spooky tower. We want to go investigate it. Who wants to come with me? I form up a party, and then I contact the DM and say, I've got these people. We want to play. Let's go. And we schedule a on-the-fly session, and we go and do that. Then that group returns. After the end of the adventure, that group reports back to the main group. Here's what we discovered. Maybe they modify a map, a shared map that they've all got. They learn a little bit more about the world, and then another group does another thing.
That sounds really interesting, and I swore beforehand that I wasn't going to derail this, but the one question that I cannot get away from is, like, how does the actual scheduling of the play session work? Like, how flexible does the DM have to be, and who pitches the date on which to play first?
So it's all player-driven, ultimately all player-driven. Now, it does require a lot of flexibility on the DM. I've only scheduled a couple sessions so far, but the way we've hammered it out is sort of, the player who's going to be the instigator contacts me and says, I want to play on next Monday. Do you have time? Okay. And I give them a yes or no, or we negotiate or whatever. And they say, okay, this is the time we're going to play. Then that player goes to the group and says, next Wednesday, I'm going to the tower to kill orcs. Who wants to come? A quasi-work related angle to it about social activities for mobile games. So kind of using it as a practical experiment in that regards.
Well, this is good because anytime I talk to anybody that like isn't in the gaming industry, I always say people who are computer game professionals in their spare time, they're playing tabletop role-playing games. So I'm glad that you are continuing to do that so I can use that as a legitimate present example.
It's 100% true, man. These days I push back a little bit of making games entirely made of my coworkers, just because that can get awkward if work talk comes in. But that said, it's just so easy. It's so easy in the video game industry to just say, who wants to play D&D? And you've got more people than you can possibly seat.
That's wonderful. Yep. That's great. So in that very interesting campaign, you are just starting them at zero and your first level.
Yep. They're all first level. Yep.
Now, I must admit that I currently start new characters at second level.
Interesting. Why is that? And
I think that, okay, this is good. Because last time I didn't come up with the correct answer. Partly it's to give a little bit more durability. Mm-hmm. Partly it's to give a little bit more options to maybe like the magic user character. But the main thing is that to begin with, I wanted to interface with traditional classic first edition modules that expected a large player size, right? Expected a large party size.
Right.
Like most of the Gygaxian modules are saying this is written for 8 players.
Sure. Six to ten feels like a very common thing I would see in print for 6 to 10.
Totally.
Yep.
That's exactly what it was. And so if I maybe expect to have only 4 players at the table, now I'm like they're down by half power.
Right.
And I suppose as I say this, one option would be like cut all the danger by half. But my response instead was to start them at second level and thereby have more or less the same power level so I could use those initial adventures.
I feel like the funny thing is what you're experiencing, what you're reacting to is a lot of the same things that the design of 5th edition reacted to. Generally, from when I read 5th edition material, the expectation is a party of about 5 people. And generally first level is more powerful. That first level has more hit points, more abilities, like they're effectively a second level character at this point.
Right, and I think that's been true for the last couple editions. Like I think from 3rd, 4th, 5th, they've just slightly ping-ponged between an expectation of 4 or 5. I think it was 5 and then 4 and then 5 or something like that. And I get that. And I'm actually thankful to 3rd edition for kind of opening my mind to at least the option of starting at different levels.
Okay.
Like 1st edition didn't really have support for that. And I see 4th and 5th edition doing that, and I'm like, I really don't like this this non-continuous split between zero level and first level is I prefer kind of like a continuous gradient there. And so my response is like, why make first level more powerful when you can just say, if you want to be more powerful, start at second level or fifth level or 10th level or whatever.
Sure.
So my math brain is slightly irritated at that discontinuity.
Gotcha.
That they built in at first level.
Right. You're talking about the rapid power change between being a common zero level human to suddenly being a first level adventurer.
Right. Yep. And does nothing exist in between? Is that just not a thing in the world?
Well, what I've seen of 5th edition is just everything's more powerful.
What? How about that? I think I won that.
I was rolling damage for kobolds and doing D4 plus 3 or 4 damage, and I was like, what is going on? What kind of world do we live in where kobolds do this much damage?
Right.
Anyway.
Right. Totally. Yeah, the hit points seem completely out of...
Everything is definitely scaled up.
Right. Right. And then to kind of polish that off, I do hear that in his later years, Gygax would start people at third level.
Interesting. So,
and you know, 3 is kind of a magic number. I get
let me get back to topic here. The reason West Marches is interesting, of course, is I have a large player base. Inevitably, some players will play more than other players, and I'm going to end up with characters of different levels, and I need to figure out how to deal with that.
Right. Let me ask it. Does anybody play West Marches in a different style? Does anybody play West Marches and just say you're all the same level forever?
I mean, I think that the original blog post has got to be at least 10 years old at this point. And was he playing third? I'm not sure. I've certainly tried it using BX. I've done a BX version of it. So sure, yeah, I'm sure people are doing it in different editions.
Right. So how do you expect to go forward? What's your plan for your campaign?
Let me contrast it with my old BX campaign that I was running, where for me it was more just about the deadliness. At that point, level disparity came up because the game was deadly and players would die, and what do you do when you make a new character? And I feel like I'm going to say we here because you and I have played in a lot of campaigns where we've tried a lot of different things. In fact, you were just Dan was just sharing with me an old email from a campaign many, many years ago where we came up with something very convoluted, where we did some math and I think decided that you came back in with 2/3 the XP of the average XP of the party.
Right. And we started with take the average XP. So you die, you're making a new character. And we started with take the average of the party and you get half of that. And the email we were just looking at it was we switched to 2/3 of the average XP of the party. And then me doing a bunch of analysis about how many levels back you are at what level in third edition.
Yeah.
We probably had an iteration past that, too.
I think we were looking for, like, you're behind, but not so behind that you're useless, right? Because that's the real problem with level disparity, right? Is you don't want a player stuck sitting there at the table who's just like, well, I can do nothing.
Right.
I'm bored.
Right.
In my BX campaign, I eventually decided, well, let me see what it's like to go hardcore. And I said, I'm just going to say, if you have to make a new character, it's first level. Tough nuts. Just deal with it. And that worked really surprisingly well. And I think it's because of the XP progression. My theory is you came in as a first level character. You're hanging out with a bunch of level 5s and 6s. And you're there for maybe one session before you jump to 2. And maybe another session and you're 3. And it was very, very quick to catch up. Such that it kind of didn't matter. And like, so yeah, you're... If you want to look at it this way, which is maybe a little mean-spirited, but your penalty for dying is you have one or two boring sessions.
Yeah, yeah. And so we're trying to navigate between the player who's complaining that they're bored because they're underpowered, but I think that with our complicated attempt at resolving that in third edition, there's always some kind of corner case whereby someone's incentivized to die. And you clearly don't want that, right? And so one example would be a player has a character, but they've stayed out for a couple sessions, right? And the whole party has advanced.
Yep.
And now that player's character is actually behind where they would be if they died and make a new character. And basically, as long, no matter what you do, there's going to be that gap built in somewhere if you do try to promote people, you know, for free.
Yep.
So I think that those systems that we were trying to come up with was attempting to navigate between that. But there's no way to avoid. There's going to be some situation with a player that's actually further behind than if they died and made a new character. And you definitely don't want to incentivize people actually killing their characters on purpose for that.
Yeah, that's totally fair. And then of course, then you start to rub into the like, well, how easy is death in this edition of the game? I think by the book third edition and later, it gets relatively hard to the point where now you're like, you know, either taking crazy risks or conspiring with your GM to have a cinematic death,
right.
Which we've gone down both those roads. It just feels weird.
Right.
Now, personally, I like a game that's reasonably deadly, and I like that. I like that players, you know, who don't die, who survive, that maybe they're a level higher than the average of everyone else. So it's not like a huge like imbalancing thing for the game. But they feel really special, right? They've got this character who has survived, and just the surviving makes the character cooler.
I feel like that's an important part of the game. I feel like that's classic D&D, and I feel like that's an important part of the game. So I agree with that.
So I had a specific instance of that where I had a player who rolled really poor stats, right? Made a first level fighter, really poor stats. But so he lost an arm, he's got really poor stats, and he decided, well, I'm just going to play like my character's got a death wish. Like, he's just depressed. And he's just going to take crazy risks, and maybe he dies and I get to make a new character, and that's fine. And he played his character to the hilt and survived time after time. Like, to the point where he was taking magic items and special abilities to compensate for the one arm, like, really right. effectively. Like, he lobbied to, like, keep the ring of protection rather than give it to the wizard because I can't hold a shield and I'm down. I need the ring of protection.
That's great.
And he was just a fantastic character and one of our favorites from that campaign. And just really cool because he survived.
That's great. At the moment, I'm slightly embarrassed that I actually haven't had a player death in my bi-weekly campaign.
Interesting.
In really surprisingly long time. It's possibly been... I actually can't remember the last time someone actually died, which I'm embarrassed about. And I don't think I'm pulling punches. There was one single wilderness encounter that I feel I screwed up in not telling the players how risky this area was, and that one I slightly cushioned.
Interesting.
But other than that one single encounter, I have not been pulling punches, and I have not gotten a death in months.
Do you think that's like player skill that they're trying to avoid death, or it is possibly your death rules maybe too generous, or...
Well, my death rolls are much worse.
Yeah.
My death rolls are much worse than if I was playing without them.
Well, sure. But there are, I mean, you know, you and I have compared notes before. Like, we have pretty different what happens true. When you get to zero true. Hit point rules.
True. I mean, I see. People generally don't go down to zero either.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, so they must be playing more conservatively.
Maybe. I mean, I did actually have a critical hit result on Friday that was... the frontline fighter took a critical, rolled like a 92 out of 100, which is terrible, which would be hits you in the chest, instant death if you don't have a shield.
Mm-hmm.
Happened to have a shield that got wrecked. So that wrecked the magic shield on Friday, actually, to save his life.
Okay. But I'm sure he was happy to have that.
Yeah, he wasn't happy about losing the magic. Then it became, well, I lost my magic item. But anyway. Yeah, people don't. Anyway, so I think it's probably player skill or something like that.
Okay.
But anyway, so one possible, as you mentioned before, one possible, like if you do have a disparity between levels, one thing we discovered on Friday was I did drain a whole bunch of levels out of the frontline fighters.
And
so,
and do you have magic in your game that restores that?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, that's like,
I didn't think about that.
You know, if you look at like first or second edition D&D, right? There are high level cleric spells that restore that. I think you have neither high level spells nor clerics, so I'm guessing that you don't have that magic in your game.
I don't.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I don't. My brain is not coming up with anything.
Okay.
I guess maybe I should enter. Anyway, I'm not expecting, I'm not planning on that. Mm-hmm. So the people that have been more consistent, they got more levels, and as a result, they take the front line because they're burlier. Yep. And as a result, when they run into level draining undead, their necks are on the line. And I did drain both the top level fighters who were fifth on Thursday and then were fourth at the end of Friday. So that actually did bring the whole party level disparity closer together. So if this is a concern in your game, may I recommend more level draining undead?
But it's not like you drained any of them down to one or anything, right? You didn't lose a lot of levels.
That's correct. They only lost one each.
That was I remember a time when I was playing a wizard. I made a first level magic user, and his whole shtick was that he had once been an incredibly powerful wizard and got level drained back down to one.
Yeah. That's a great character. I will say that the two players that did get hit, I mean, you know, so it, when it happened, it wasn't clear whether there's going to be more coming or not.
Right.
So I must admit, they looked really green in the face as they were deciding on what to do in the next round. And for one of the players, this is the first time they'd ever seen level drain in their life. So, you know, playing the horrible Wraith, I turned to them and said, you know, your life energy is delicious, and I'm looking forward to consuming more of it.
Oh, no.
Or, but it's up to you. You can run away, and I'm happy to drain your compatriots instead. So it's up to you. And that player looked really, really sick as they decided to stay in the fight instead. Yeah.
That's great. That's great. Oh, man.
And okay. Also, they don't have any they don't have any magic weapons, basically. So they also have to fight with just silver daggers.
Oh, that's terrible! No magic weapons. Why?
Yeah, they have one single magic sword, but that particular person didn't have any.
And they're like fifth level. Are you intentionally keeping the magic low?
I'm kind of not. I did an analysis recently. What I am doing is I'm using just by the book OD&D treasure tables.
Okay.
And they're very minimal, and so. Yep. In like about a month or two ago, I did an analysis and I said, when a magic item shows up, it really ought to be 1d6 magic items. So just recently, there's somewhat more magic items available to be found.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So dealing with it, once you're in this situation, you have characters of different levels. I proposed my original thing. I think I'm going to show this, this math that we did so we can show it a little bit. So I did some quick math on just charting out the XP per level across editions, because my theory for my old campaign, right, was that, as you could see, you know, you have this geometric progression of XP per level, and that the idea being that there's so much XP between levels, say, 5 and 6, that the amount of XP for your party to go generally from level 5 to level 6 is enough for another player to go from level 1 to level 5. So that's the theory, is that, like, you'll never really have a huge amount of disparity at the high end, right? You might have a player who's playing catch up, but they'll catch up very quickly.
Right.
And now, as we can see in the chart, that seems like maybe not the case anymore in third and fifth editions. Sorry for fourth edition fans that I don't have the numbers for that here.
Right. Right.
It's
also interesting to reflect that, you know, with the geometric progression, things like a plus 10 or 20% for abilities, or some people like to do that for racial modifiers, is practically totally negligible. The amount of time that'll make a one level difference is almost never. So at least with classic D&D, like as an example, I mean, I hadn't thought about it, but I discovered, like, when I drained the levels from the two players on Friday night, just one level each, and just using actually first edition core experience, I actually drained more than half their XP.
Right. Yep, that makes sense.
So I wonder if it might be more horrifying to come to the table and tell people, like undead energy drain sucks out half your XP every time they hit you. If that might be really the same thing, but far more horrifying.
Yep, that's true. I guess then you got to answer the question of how's that work for multi-class characters, which is maybe a little convoluted.
Correct, or below first level, or above ninth, where the numbers all change.
I'm just looking here at the fifth edition chart, because one of the things that this chart here doesn't show us is it looks like third and fifth are pretty close to each other, fifth curving up a little bit more.
Yeah.
But what you're missing here is at the low levels, fifth is much lower than third, right? The first level is 300 XP, second level is 900 XP. I think in third edition, first level is 1,000 XP. Then that implies that the curve of fifth edition is steeper than that of third. And maybe OD&D and AD&D having such bigger numbers at the high end is making it hard to see that in the chart.
Right.
But I don't know. I think honestly, I'm kind of inclined to at least try it that way for my West Marches game and not correct it until it becomes a problem.
Okay. Yeah, it's quite. I mean, having just seen it literally 1 minute before we started here, seeing the first level bump at just 300 XP was pretty eye-opening. I wouldn't have expected that.
Yeah, that was surprising to me, too, when I started playing. I thought, well, 300. And then I thought, oh, the numbers in general must be just very depressed. But no, I guess it's, it's just, they're just starting at a lower, much lower initial value. And then, I mean, it's three times the XP to get from second to third, that is to get from first to second.
Talk for a while. Leave that up and talk for a while I crunch some numbers.
We have the raw numbers here in front of us that Dan's now looking at and wants to do a little math on. Can I entertain? This is sort of like that time when Dan got held by a magic user, I had to vamp for a minute. So I guess I could think out loud a little bit about other options. What other options are there? I mean, certainly I've played with groups that want to just say XP is XP. You know, everyone's all the same level all the time, regardless. This plays actually a little bit. Here's another fifth edition ism that's going to be surprising to you, Dan. There's an XP-less leveling system in fifth edition, which appears to be possibly the default. At least when you go into D&D Beyond, the option is to do quote unquote milestone leveling, and then XP leveling is an option you have to switch into. XP or milestone leveling being basically like when the story hits this point, everyone levels up.
Right. I've heard about that. A lot of people like that.
William Hellman has posted to our chat that says, I think they want you to hurry up through those first three levels when you make your quote path choices, which is also true. Yet in fifth edition, there are some important choices you make in those first couple of levels. For example, if you're playing a magic user, second level is the level where you choose your school, right? So you're doing kind of important path through the class choices in those first couple of levels that are very defining to your character later on. Good point, William. So that could be it. Certainly, it doesn't remain times three. As we keep going up, it slows down a bit after that.
Seems like so having crunched these numbers and I'm sure someone has done fifth edition more than 15 seconds like I just did. Doesn't seem like there's actually any pattern to it. The increments and the ratio of the increments just kind of bounce around randomly. Unlike any other edition, so what I was expecting to say when we started was that clearly classic D&D, original D&D first edition are a geometric basis that are multiplying each step.
Yep.
Third edition is more like an arithmetic sequence whereby in the limit you're adding a particular number at each step for the increment. And then fifth edition is like all over the map unless I've misentered something. It's like
David Heron is commenting in the chat with something that backs up your all over the map comment there of just saying that like the XP per monster kill in 5e makes the curve really weird. He's playing with level 10 characters and he's seeing a wide dramatic changes between different types of monsters. I'm not sure. Yeah, fifth edition is strange. I definitely agree with that. Also, in fifth edition, assuming you are going with XP, the only things I've seen that give XP, and we hinted at this in the beginning, I think I'm gonna take down this chart. The only thing we've seen that gives XP in fifth edition is either sort of story-based stuff, like you rescue the princess, or monster kills. And monster kills definitely have, then they get into their crunchy math just like they did in third of like, what's the CR and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
We have a whole discussion about that system. So there's no XP for treasure anymore.
Right.
And certainly when I've run, when I run OED or BX, I say that the majority of XP comes from treasure.
Right.
I give a little bit for killing monsters just for the sake of it.
Yeah.
But most XP comes from treasure, which of course makes leveling in those systems really spiky because it's all about, can you identify where there's a hall?
Right. Right. And I mean, I feel like a benefit of that is that you know, if you want to be a sneaky thief or a, I don't know, teleporting in wizard and steal the treasure that way, you know, that gets you the benefit, the leveling up.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That way. Well, I guess where some people would refer to that as a story reward.
Yeah, but I think it definitely, for me, I felt like that always encouraged a certain theme to the game and a sort of like a self-interestedness of the characters, right? Yeah. You're playing more kind of swords and sorcery, you know, Conan-esque, where really you're out for making your life better and less about like, I'm going to save the world. Whereas definitely more modern D&D, I think, prefers that flavor of sort of like, we're the epic heroes who are going to save the world from the evils that reside.
That could very well be like the number one difference, but thematically, between original D&D and modern. So do you remember when, or maybe one of our commenters remembers when, what edition dialed out the XP for treasure? Like, was that gone as of third edition or?
Ooh, that's a good question. Yeah, I don't remember if that's there in third or not.
I kind of feel like that might have been gone as of third edition.
It was certainly there in first, right?
Yeah.
And I would presume that means it's probably there in second, since second is
100%
refinement. Although David and William both think that 2E is where it goes away. That could be. That could be a thing. They dropped it in 2E. There's some weird stuff in 2E, man. There's little interesting changes that poked
Mr. in. Cook, Mr. David Cook, what did you do?
Yeah. So if you're going in that direction of, so this is funny. My Sunday group that I play with are more of the like, just give everyone the same XP all the time. We don't want to deal with players who have different numbers. It's just annoying. And at which point, like, you start to see the reasoning behind something like, say, a milestone advancement system, where you're just gonna say, okay, well, at certain points, we're just gonna decide the whole party levels up and we're done. But does that save you from disparity? Not really. What if someone dies? I guess you could decide that everyone's just starts new character at exactly the same level where he left off. What do you think of that idea, Dan? Dan's trying to do math.
Sorry, say it again?
We've distracted Dan with math.
Yeah,
he's ensorcelled again.
Yeah, I am. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the second edition rulebook. I think that the core treasure awards are still in second edition, but they do have a bunch of options for story goals or optionally XP for, as an option, the DM can award the XP for cash value of non-magical treasures. Wait, no, non-magical, oh crap, you're right.
Well, non-magical, right?
That's okay, point. You're right, it's an option. Those guys are right.
Yep.
Great, thank you for that. Wow, I wouldn't have guessed that. Thank you for saying that.
Interesting, very interesting.
Yeah, it's gone as a core rule, but it's only there as an option, huh?
Yeah.
Crazy. All right, anyway, I'm back.
So, other ways of dealing with disparity, right? Because I think all these things that we've talked about, nothing is going to save you from the fact that disparity can happen, right?
Right.
Characters die. Again, I guess my question that I was just posing to you, Dan, was like, what about everyone always has the same amount of XP forevermore? If you die, you come back exactly the same point where you left off. New character, but same level.
Yeah, I think some people do that. I don't, it makes me really, it's hard for me to see that in a campaign.
Yeah.
Why is that?
You feel like it cheapens death?
Yeah, and I feel like it doesn't incentivize play. I'm like, there's really no incentive for playing better or worse or showing up or participating or just Like I saw another blogger refer to this as like, you have some players who are active and some players who are just audience members. And it seems like if XP is the reward for what you want to see in the game, you just turned it into, I don't want to see anything in the game.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yep, I could see that.
Yeah. What's your take on that? Why not
yeah,
do that?
Yeah, I find it dissatisfying as well. And for me, I think it's about making the game, it's similar to, say, hiding your dice rolls, right? As a DM, whenever I roll the dice, I always roll them in front of the screen for everyone to see. And generally, that's not because I'm worried that they're going to think I'm cheating and screwing them. More so, I'm worried that I'm going to accidentally cheat because I'm rooting for them and I don't want them to die. The fact is, I am a fan of my players' characters and I like seeing what they do, and I may pull my punches without really thinking about it. So I roll my dice in front of the screen. So I think that part of that, and part of why my players, I think, like that, if I can speak for them, is that it makes the danger feel real, right? That there's real consequence to their actions. I think that if I can just make a brand new character with the same amount of XP as I had prior, what are the consequences to death, really?
That is pure gold. If we could like cut out what you just said and like post that everywhere, that was absolutely 100% pure gold. I totally agree with that. And you know, if I think on Friday night in the battle with the level draining undead, and I was, you know, about to rolling a die, I did a little math in my head and I said, for you, I need to roll a 16 or above to hit you, well armored fighter type. And you know, threw the die and I mean, they were really terrified, right? So everybody was leaning keenly at that die roll because it wasn't really up to me at that point. I'd set the stakes.
Yes.
And there was clearly a lot of terror at what was going to come up on that die roll. And, if I were doing it behind the screen, it would have there wouldn't have been anything for them to lean over the table to experience.
Yeah. Stake setting is huge, I think. I think that's, especially if you are playing old school style where there's not a lot of rules for things and you're just making up the odds in your head, stating them out loud before you roll the dice is so important, I think. You know, being clear, these are the stakes, here's what's going to happen, now roll the dice.
It's really interesting because this came up on the OD&D discussions forum a couple weeks ago, and there was a sharp difference of opinion on this.
Interesting.
There were several people that vociferously argued for exactly the opposite of, I think the counter argument was, I'm the DM, I'm a storyteller, I want to stay in charge of my story.
It's a write your book around.
Right. And there was also like, we're going to roll a die, and obviously if it's really high, I'll say that's good for you. And obviously if it's really low, I'll say that's bad for you. And if it's in the middle, I will ask you to roll again. Or something like that.
Yeah.
So it was kind of surprising to see that, but some people were actually very much anti-setting the stakes so that as DM they could have their hand on the rudder. But it's surprising to hear that because I think having tried both ways, right, over the years, I think that setting the stakes and letting the die be the oracle has much better emotional effect.
I agree with that. I think it also gives the players the moment to realize, you know, what are their odds, right? Like if you say, okay, well, you know, the player describes what they want to do and you say, okay, well, I think you have a, you know, 4 in 6 chance of that succeeding and here I'm going to roll. It gives the player the opportunity to go, wait, only 4 in 6? I thought it was a sure thing. Maybe I'm going to do something else.
Great. I agree.
So I think that's really big. I don't know. There are times, to qualify this, there are times where I do roll behind the screen, but it's rare, and it's usually when I feel like the player is doing something where they wouldn't know the outcome, right? These are things like, I search the door for traps, right, is the classic one. Great, I'm going to roll that behind the screen and tell you yes or no, and you're not going to know based on having seen the die whether it's no because you failed or no because there really is no trap there.
Yeah, I'm 100% on the same. So surveillance detection stuff, that I roll behind the screen. Yeah. In fact, I actually, on Friday, I just had, so we both have players have little place cards on the screen. So on Friday, I actually added, I asked them to put your intelligence bonus, which I use for searching, on your place card specifically for that purpose when I roll that die.
Interesting.
So it is the one thing that I roll behind the screen too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Any other thoughts on what we can do about level disparity?
More undead.
It's funny because I generally take level drain out of my games. Typically what I do is I have a table of alternate abilities. So I give undead other weird abilities, which I think makes them feel a little more custom, a little more interesting, and takes the threat of level drain off the table. It's interesting to hear you say level drain as an actual solution to a problem.
It should be up to the players whether they charge into the undead location or not. I'm not actually saying throw more undead in order to even out the level disparity. But that happened, that it did just coincidentally happen on Friday. That's what's happened. So maybe someone does want to do that. So it's interesting, you know, it's really nice to have your experience with, we both tried to deal with the disparity issue a number of ways. And particularly with classic D&D, you being happy with just setting people back to the floor, that is what I currently do. Not having had a lot of deaths lately, it seemed to work out, you know, reasonably well. Knowing that any other solution always has some kinds of problems or gaps, I agree that I think it's the best thing to do at this point.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I feel like where we're ending up here is it's sort of an all or nothing choice, right? Either just knock them all the way down to first and start over, or keep them just exactly at the same level and just go, go, go. But anything in the middle ultimately always feels a little ham-fisted and is maybe difficult and painful to deal with and ultimately never quite hits the mark.
Yep. I agree. It's always, somehow that's always broken. You're right.
Dan, I wanted to bring up another interesting angle of this, because I know you've done some research in this, which is sort of like, well, if you're going to come back in as a new character who is higher level, I think you have different rules for that, don't you, that you used? We've modeled, like, that's survivability good. Of characters and changed how you roll stats based on what level character you're making.
That's a really good point. Yeah, if you look at my OED house rules, I guess in the judge's rules technically, some time ago, and this is actually why I wrote this really elaborate program that I call the Arena Program that simulates millions of fighters going into an arena and fighting each other and then getting demographic results of hit points, levels, abilities. So I used that analysis, and yes, if you come into my game at a higher level, you get slightly better ability rolls, which is purely just a reflection of what would happen in this Darwinian, survivability contest. Mm-hmm. So it's not that I, want people to be more powerful, but I'm just trying to keep them at the same level they would from just having survived that stuff. So I think even at first level, I give people one ability score at 2d6 plus 6 that you get to pick. Everything else has to be 3d6 in order. And then I think by fourth level, you get maybe three abilities at 2d6 plus 6. And it does kind of increment up a bit up to like name level.
And all that's meant to simply model the nature of how much stats increase your survivability.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And how much do you actually use that, I guess?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. It comes up more in tournament games when we're creating characters that are starting at a higher level.
Right.
So starting my characters at second level, they get this, one ability at 2d6 plus 6. Everybody knows it. Again, we made up characters once, and then really to my surprise, everybody could make up their own character without any oversight on my part after that. So it was happily straightforward that everybody could instantly remember it.
Yeah, I mean, even 2d6 plus 6 is no guarantee, right? I could get an 8, so...
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
So we have, we have a wizard that doesn't have any intelligence bonus right at the moment that's a little gimpy. And stuff like that. And I also have, a lot of people give, max hit points for first level. I don't do that, but I do give, if you're being created at a higher level, you get to reroll ones or twos.
FYI, max hit points at first level is by the book in 5th edition.
Yeah, I think that's been the case since 3rd.
Oh, has it? Okay.
Yeah, even since third, you get max. You got max hit points. So that's kind of been standard for a while. Yeah, it's weird to me that everybody's all starting at the same hit points. So I wouldn't want to do that. But if you're creating a character at sixth level, you're getting that benefit for fully six levels worth. In my game.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Again, just purely not that I wanted the characters, not that I wanted to be nice to anybody, but that just simulates the Darwinian effect that I've seen in my analysis.
Right. Yeah. Awesome. Well, if anybody wants to check that out, I believe Arena is available on oedgames.com. Is that right?
Yep. I think there's a link there. It's, you know, I actually have the code on GitHub.
Great.
If anybody wants to see that, so GitHub/DanielRCollins1 is my handle there. And the end rule is on Original Edition Delta's house rules. Yeah, I'm happy with it. Works pretty well.
Great. Yep. Any final thoughts on level disparity?
It's really interesting that we have cycled, you know, over many years with what's in by the book Original D&D, tried to get smarter about it and just didn't really come up with anything that really did better. So here we are again of just like, you go down to the floor, try really hard not to die.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is I feel like we spent a lot of time trying to fix a perceived problem that wasn't really based on experience.
Yeah.
And ultimately finally came back to like, well, let's actually experience what it's like by the book. And it turns out not so bad.
Yeah. That's one of those things whereby it doesn't happen every day, right?
Yeah.
Like hitting somebody with a sword, you're going to get to experience that a whole bunch of times every night and decide whether you're happy with it. And the character going out at a particular level and coming in at a particular level happens a little bit more rarely, and so it's slightly harder to get good data about whether we're happy about what's happening there or not.
Right. So for my West Marches game, I think I'm gonna just have them come back or just not deal with the level disparity. Right. If they die or if they miss sessions, they're just lower level and they're just gonna have to deal. And I'll see how that rolls out. And I figure it's better to err on the side of lower powered, of making, you know, finding those pain points and then fixing them if and when I discover them. And I'll
be
happy to report back what I discover.
Yeah, hopefully we'll have another discussion on a future date where we get to see exactly how your West Marches campaign is going with that.
Yeah, certainly. I'm certainly posting about it quite a lot on my blog right now. It's in the very early days, like I said, so I've got a lot of sessions up front because interest is very high, and I'm kind of trying to remain a little detached from it because, like I said, I've tried to do this once in the past and it actually fizzled out after just a couple sessions. So sure. I'm prepared that might be the end result here, but maybe it'll catch on and everyone will love it. We'll see.
What's the starting frequency like? So you have how many sessions and how many days or weeks?
I've gone a little over the into the deep end here. we had one session last Wednesday. I have the next two scheduled for Monday and Wednesday of this coming week, which is
fantastic.
Possibly too much. Like if it really becomes that I'm running games twice a week every week, then I have a theory that maybe I will try to rope in a second DM.
Oh, also fantastic.
Which would also be interesting. But maybe it's just that level of interest again, just because it's just getting kicked off.
Possibly.
Yeah. So,
well, I hope it continues. I hope it continues successfully.
Thanks. Yeah. I'll let you know.
Great.
Cool. So I think that's our take on level disparity. If you have any interesting experiences where you've tried different things and can tell us the results, we'd love to hear it. Please post in our comments. Basically just tell us your thoughts. We'd love to hear them.
Maybe you have some system that we haven't thought about to deal with that we'd like to hear about.
Sure. Now, of course, if you have ideas of other stuff you'd like to hear us talk about, or if we touched on something and you'd like to hear us go deeper, please, by all means, get in touch and let us know, and we'll be happy to focus a future live stream on that.
And as always, please do subscribe to our channel here on YouTube, YouTube/WanderingDMs. That does help us out a lot, and we plan to be here live every other Sunday at 1 p.m., so should be back in about 2 weeks. Please come back then and join us for another thought-provoking discussion, and we will talk to you next time.
Dan, looking at the calendar real quick, is 2 weeks the 4th of July? Or are we off by one? I know that we...
It's the 30th.
That's the 30th. Okay, great. Great.
Yeah, so two weeks from now, we ought to be back on June 30th.
Excellent.
And then after that, week of 4th of July, we're planning a live streaming play all weekend long.
Yep.
So join us for the 30th and then come back the week of the 4th when you can to see us actually playing with Paul here DMing all weekend of the 4th. And we're really looking forward to seeing how that works out.
Yeah. Yeah, and watch for updates, for last-minute updates about our schedule for streaming. Please check us out on Twitter. That's at WanderingDMs. And we will try to keep that up to date with what's going on. And that's I think that's all we have.
I think that's it, and we will see you next time.
So long, everyone.